Ian was nearly purple and very swollen. That was it. The child was stuck, the crown of its head battering with each spasm, but not able to come further. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said, and both her eyes popped open in astonishment. "Never mind," I said. "When it lets go," for the next pain was coming, I could see it in her face, "lean back against the wall." Her husband, I assumed that must be the man who'd slapped Agnes, seemed to have gone outside and was apostrophizing the night in an incoherent mix of Cherokee and English. "Right," I said, as calmly as possible, and put off my cloak and shawl. "Let's just see what we have here, shall we, Susanna?" There were splashes of blood on the dirt floor, but it was dark with large visible clots. Just bloody show. She wasn't hemorrhaging, though there was a slick of blood on her thighs. Her waters had broken some time earlier. It was hot, and the small room smelled like a Jurassic swamp, fecund and reeking. The contractions were coming every minute, powerful ones. I had only moments between them in which her belly relaxed enough for me to palpate it. But on the second try, I thought I felt the muscles of her belly tightened like an iron band, and I counted under my breath, hands still on her. Relaxation. I knew where the head was. Was the child facing backward? I pressed hard on the relaxed belly, trying to find the curve of the spine. It will be all right. Count with me, Susanna. 1, 2... I counted silently. 22 seconds, and the contraction eased. Spine. There was the blunt point of an elbow, and there, a curve that had to be the child's spine. Only it wasn't. Bloody fucking hell, I said, and Susanna made a noise that might have been a groan or an exhausted laugh. The rest of my attention was focused on the thing under my hand. It wasn't the curve of a spine, nor yet of buttocks. It was the curve of another head. It vanished with a new contraction, but I kept my hand doggedly on the spot, and as soon as the spasm waned, I felt frantically to and fro. My first panic thought, a memory of a double-headed infant seen in a jar of spirits of wine, disappeared, succeeded by something that was partly relief, partly new alarm. "It's twins," I said to Susanna. "Did you know that?" She shook her head to and fro, slow as an ox.
"Thought, maybe. You sure?"
"Oh, yes," I said, in a tone that made her laugh again, though the sound was cut off abruptly by the next contraction. The relief caused by the thought that we probably weren't dealing with a gross deformity was fading fast, replaced by the next thought. If the first baby wasn't moving, it was perhaps caught in an umbilical cord, possibly dead, or entangled with its twin in some fashion. Further palpitations, pushing when I thought I had an idea what I was pushing on, groping for a mental picture of what might be going on inside. But even the best midwife can only tell so much, and the only thing I was reasonably sure about was that the placenta, one placenta or two, if it was one, it might rip loose with the first birth, and then we'd have an abruption that will kill the mother, hadn't yet detached. Though given the position of the baby's head, there could easily be gallons of blood backed up behind the infant. No. I looked at Susanna's face. No. If she were hemorrhaging, she'd be white and losing consciousness. As it was, she was bright red and clearly still fighting. But we didn't have much time. Two umbilical cords, either of which could be wrapped around a neck or slipped down between the child and the pelvic bones and be crushed with a contraction, starving one child of oxygen. And that was the least of it. My mind ran rapidly down the list of potential problems. Some I could dismiss on the grounds of what I could see and feel. Some, like the faint horror of its being conjoined twins, I could dismiss on grounds of high odds against. Others, on grounds that I couldn't do a thing about them, even if I knew what was going on. That still left a few to be worried about. And the child was not moving. It was alive. I could feel a pulse when I got my fingertips briefly on the head, and it was oriented properly, face down. I could feel the biparietal sutures in the skull, but it wasn't moving. My shoulders ached, and so did my hips and knees from kneeling on the dirt floor so long, but I felt it dimly, an irrelevant observation. I had one hand in her vagina, the other on her belly, probing through the wall of skin and muscle, feeling for some pattern in the tangle of tiny limbs. Susanna's sweat was slick and hot under my hands. That was good. The wetness helped me feel movements. The contraction came on with a force that smashed my fingers between skull and pelvis and made Susanna scream and me bite my lip not to. Such force in a woman who'd already given birth 3 times should have shot the baby out like a greased pig. It hadn't, and now I was sure what was wrong. "The twins are tangled together," I said as calmly as I could. I pressed her stomach and felt movement. One twin, at least, was still alive. I was drenched with sweat, and my mouth was dry. Someone had set a cup of water near me. I hadn't noticed. I picked it up and drank to get enough moisture to say what had to be said next. "Susanna," I said, leaning forward to look into her eyes, "the babies can't get out. I can't get them out. If we keep doing this, they'll die, and you might die too." "Easily." I took a deep breath. Her hand had come down to rest on mine, atop her rigid belly.
"Wait,"
she whispered, and clenched my hand as we all rode the next contraction. When it relaxed, she was panting, but squeezed my hand lightly and let go.
"What else?"
she said, between gasps. "I can cut you open and take the babies out," I said. "It will be awful, and it will be painful, but..."
"It can't be worse than this,"
she said, and then did laugh, hoarse as a crow. I lowered my head and rested my forehead for a moment against her belly, controlling my own emotions, preparing myself.
"Will I die then?"
she said, her voice quite matter-of-fact. "Very likely," I said, straightening up and matching her tone. I wiped a sleeve across my face and shoved the loose hair out of my eyes.
"But it might save the babies."
"I'll do my best." She nodded and clutched my shoulder fiercely as the next contraction came on.
"Save them,"
she said, as soon as it passed, and dropped her head, breathing like a winded horse. The energy of emergency flooded me, and I stood up, looking about the cabin for the first time. It was tiny and sparsely furnished, with one bedstead and a pallet rolled up at the foot, a table and benches, and a cauldron on the fire steaming, thank God. And much to my surprise, Jamie, calmly unrolling the bundle that held my surgical knives on the table. "Where did you come from?" I said, and added, glancing round the cabin, "Where's Mr. Cloudtree?"
"Cold as a dead trout," he said, nodding toward the half-open door. "Drunk, I mean."
I caught a glimpse of a small white face through the gap. Agnes, eyes huge with fear.
"Mind your brothers, lass," he said calmly to her. "It'll be all right."
I made what I hoped was a smile toward Agnes and stepped closer to the table. I started pulling things out of my kit as fast as I could.
"Did you hear what I said to her?"
I asked, low voice, with a nod at Mrs. Cloudtree's grunting form.
"I did," he said, equally low-voiced, "and so did the wee lass."
He glanced at the door. Agnes was still there. When she saw me looking, she sidled in.
"The boys are asleep with Pa in the shed," she said in a rush. "I can help. Please let me help."
"Agnes," said Susanna faintly, raising her head. Before I could say anything, Agnes had shot to her mother's side and was hugging her round the shoulders. Tears were pouring down her face, but she was saying,
"It'll be all right, Ma. Mr. Fraser said so."
Susanna raised one arm as though it weighed a ton and slowly pushed back her sopping hair with her wrist to fix an eye on Jamie.
"You say so, Mr. Fraser."
"Aye, I do," he said.
She went purple and bit her lip, breathing heavily through her nose, head hanging. When the pain let go, she raised it as though it were as heavy as the big iron cauldron.
Your wife says, I'm going to die. Aye, well, I've got more faith in her than she does. But I suppose it's your choice who to believe.
He glanced at me, hands half curled for action.
What do you want to do, Sassenach?
She needs to be lying down. My mind was made up, and I already had what I needed laid out on the bench. Can you get her onto the bed, quickly? Susanna had been panting, eyes closed. At this, her eyes sprang open, and she straightened, clutching her belly.
Not the bed. You ain't going to spoil my good feather bed. Ah!
She curled up like a shrimp again. Agnes was breathing so hard I thought she might faint, but no time to worry about it.
The floor, then, I said briefly.
Hurry. Stand back, Agnes. Between us, Jamie and I heaved her up, turned her, and laid her down as carefully as we could. She was tremendously heavy, very ungainly, and slick with sweat, though, and came down on the pounded dirt with a solid bump, at which she uttered a wild cry. And Jamie said something very blasphemous in Gaelic.
Bloody hell,
I said under my breath, and reaching for the bottle of dilute alcohol, I pushed the soggy folds of her shift up and sloshed it over the huge belly, fish-white and striped with purple-red stretch marks.
All right, I said,
and snatched the heaviest of my surgical scalpels. Jamie, hold her.
Oh, you've got her. Good.
Muttering, Jesus, Mary and Bride, bloody help me, I laid the blade at the base of her navel. But before I could make the incision, she screamed as though the touch of cold metal had been a cattle prod, jerked her knees up, then drove her heels down into the dirt, arched her back, thumped down again, and...
What the devil's that? Jamie said, trying to look over the obstruction of Mrs. Cloudtree's belly.
It's a head, I said.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, push, Susanna!
She hadn't waited for instructions. With a ferocious noise, she pushed, and the baby did shoot out like a greased pig. I caught him. Was it a him? Yes, it was, in my apron. I thumped his nose and mouth clear, turned him over, and thumped his wet back lightly. The tiny buttocks squeezed together in protest, relaxed, and let out a small spurt of dark fecal matter, but he was making regular huffing noises, sounding much like his mother, though not nearly as loud. Agnes, I shouted. She was already at my shoulder as I turned, and I detached my apron, wrapped it hastily round the infant, and thrust him into her arms.
Shall I cut the cord, Sassenach?
Jamie was squatting by my other side, ski and do in hand. Yes, I said breathlessly, and forgot about it, thrusting my hand into the birth canal, hoping for another head.
No such luck.
Limbs everywhere in the tight, slippery dark. I closed my eyes to see better, feeling urgently for a foot. Just one, I prayed. Just one foot. And then a powerful contraction came on, quite different, like an ocean wave rolling through Susanna's body, but slowly enough that I managed to get my hand out of the way. And there it was, a tiny foot, its limp toes tinged with unearthly blue.
Bloody, bloody, bloody.
I realized that I was muttering senseless things and clamped my jaw tight. I knew it was too late, but there was nothing else to be done. Once more I reached up, fumbling into the dark, and this time found the other foot without trouble. Without trouble, because the baby wasn't moving. A sense of remoteness came over me, and I closed my eyes and swallowed, feeling the solid stillness of a tiny body come into my hands. They call it stillbirth, because it is. Not because the child is dead, but because everything, everything goes quiet. A tiny, still girl. I knew she was gone, but stubbornness made me lift her and try to push breath into the still lungs, my fingers on the tiny chest, hoping against hope. But she was gone. And yet the vivid joy of the first birth was still fizzing through my body,
I could hear the baby yelling his indignation, and Susanna's breath, a deep, slow panting, low voices, and the crackle of the fire, the bubbling of water in the cauldron. But all of it was wrapped in silence. The beating of my own heart, all I felt. It was peace, a deep peace, not yet sorrow. And I held the tiny body and used my hem to wipe her. Yes, her. Tiny face, eyes closed, never to open. A moment longer, and then I placed her on a clout that Agnes had brought, and turned to take care of her mother. You have a son, Susanna, I said softly. Agnes, bring him, will you? She did, biting her lip in concentration not to drop him. He was a good size, considering his prematurity, and the fact that he was a twin, but still weighed less than 5 pounds. I set him on Susanna's chest, and her arm came slowly up to hold him, cupping his head.
It'll be all right, darling,
she said to him, her voice ragged and deep from screaming.
Don't take on now.
Her eyes were closed, but she spoke to me.
The other one?
I'm sorry, I said softly, and squeezed her hand.
You have a son.
She drew a breath that went all the way down to her ravaged womb.
Thank you, ma'am, she whispered.
The little boy was still making noises like an angry hornet, but she moved him to her breast and thumbed the nipple into his mouth, and the noise stopped abruptly. Sweat was stinging my eyes, running down my neck. I sat back on my heels and wiped my face on my skirt. Susanna made a deep gasping sound, and the swollen leg pressing against my shoulder stiffened. The afterbirth was coming. I took hold of the umbilical cord, this still attached to the still body on the hearth, and the placenta, quite large, tumbled out like a deer's liver, dark and bloody. Susanna grunted again, and the second placenta slithered out. All right, I said, gathering myself. Agnes, put a quilt over your mother. Susanna, I'm going to need your belly to help your womb contract and make the bleeding stop. I had turned to find a menstrual cloth from my kit, and as I turned back, I saw Jamie. He was on his knees on the hearth, looking down at the dead little girl, with an expression on his face that stopped my heart. He looked up, feeling my glance, and we read the name in each other's face. Faith. I nodded, my throat closing with a grief as sharp as it had been when I had lost her. Jamie bowed his head and, reaching out, touched the tiny wrinkled body, his hand nearly covering her. A tear fell and glistened on the back of his hand, another on the curve of her forehead, red in the firelight. Moved by the deepest of memories, I leaned over and picked her up, holding her against my breast, tiny head cupped in my hand. In an instant, I was holding my lost daughter, grief knifing through me. I closed my eyes, knowing I had to put her down, had to go about my job, but unable to let her go, feeling the slow beating of my heart against the fading warmth of her fragile skin. I couldn't let her go. I couldn't let Faith go. They had taken her from my arms finally, left me empty, alone, in that place of cold stone. Snot was running down my face, tickling my lip, and I rubbed at it with my sleeve, still holding the child to my breast, listening to my heart break again.
Let me take her, Sassenach,
Jamie whispered, and held out his hands. I swallowed hard. I had to let her go. I can't, I said. I can't. And bowed my head over the little girl I'd lost, rocking back and forth on my knees, feeling my heart beat in chest and ears and fingertips, trying to make up for the heart that would never beat again. I didn't know how long it was that I stayed there, curled around the child, trying futilely to give her my heat, my life. There was nothing sudden, no sound, no movement. But in the midst of the searing grief, I slowly realized something. It didn't happen. It was already there. But I hadn't felt it, and now I did. Claire?
Jamie's hand touched my shoulder, and I seized it with my free hand and held on.
Warmth, strength.
Stay, I said to him and to her, breathless.
Stay?
My heart. I was still feeling it, distinctly, slow and regular. I let go of Jamie's hand, but he didn't take it away. Holding the baby in one arm, I laid my other hand on her back, feeling.
No sensation. Nothing I could really say I felt.
But there was something there. I pressed lightly on her back, waited for the space of a breath, pressed again. And again. Hearing my own heartbeat in my ears, in the pulse of my blood, pressed my heartbeat into her back, into her chest, where it pressed against me.
Push!
My fingers were warm, and so was the child.
The fire, I thought dimly. Crackle of fire and the sound of my heart. Thup-tup, thup-tup, thup-tup.
And suddenly I heard Roger telling me what Dr. McEwen had done, a hand on Buck's breast, tapping slowly and patiently, over and over, in the rhythm of a beating heart.
Thup-tup, thup-tup, thup-tup.
There were more sounds in the room now. Soft voices, the spitting of a cracking log, the wind under the eaves of the roof, the rushing sound of pines and the sloshing of water. Movement, warmth, life. Jamie's hand solid on my shoulder. I heard it all. I felt it all. But it was removed from me, happening in another world. All I was the sound of a heartbeat. And in some enormity of time, I knew that there were two of us in that sound, a sharing of the beat of a heart, the knowledge of life. My finger tapping, slow and sure.
Thup-tup, thup-tup.
Mulva. I saw her in my mind's eye, dead in the garden, and the smell of blood and the scent of birth. The tiny boy I'd taken from her body, barely alive. A blue spark in my hands that dwindled and died.
A blue spark.
I saw it. And looked deep into it, willing it to stay, holding it safe in the palms of my hands.
Thup.
My fingers stilled, and the small sound answered.
Tup.
I gradually became aware of my own breath, and after that felt the solidness of Jamie, and realized that he was holding me upright, an arm around my middle, his other hand on my breast above the baby's head. I lifted my own head, nearly blind from the brilliant darkness I'd been in, and saw the silhouette of a girl against the fire, her body dark and thin through the white of her shift.
"I cut the cord for you, Mrs. Fraser," Agnes said, "and I kneaded Mam's belly like she told me. Do you want a cup of cider? Pa drank all the beer."
"She would, lass," Jamie said, and gently let me go. "But first... bring a wee blanket for your sister, aye?"
It was dark outside. The moon had set, and dawn was some way off. It was cold, but the cold didn't touch me. I let him take the baby at last, felt his hands on mine as he took her, warm and sure, his face filled with light. He'd knelt carefully and given the baby to Susanna, placing his hand on the child in benediction. Then he'd stood and wrapped me in my cloak and walked me outside. I couldn't feel the ground beneath my feet or see the forest, but the cold air smelled of pine and lay like a balm on my heated skin.
"All right, Sassenach," he whispered.
I seemed to be leaning against him, though I didn't remember doing it. I'd lost track of where my body began and ended. The pieces seemed to be floating about in a loose sort of cloud of exultation. I felt Jamie's hands tremble a little as he touched my face. From exhaustion, I thought. The same small, constant quiver seemed to be running through me from crown to sole like a low-voltage current of electricity. In fact, I'd passed clear through exhaustion and out the other side, as one does sometimes in moments of great effort. You know that your bodily energy has been used up, and yet there's a supernatural sense of mental clarity and a strange capacity to keep moving, but at the same time, you see it all simultaneously from outside yourself and from your deepest core. The usual intervening layers of flesh and thought have become transparent. I'm fine, I said, and I laughed, let my forehead fall against his chest and breathe for a moment, feeling all my pieces come to rest, whole again, as the enchantment of the last hour faded into peace. Jamie, I said, a few moments later, raising my head, what colour is my hair? This was an absurd question. It was the depth of the night, and we were standing in a pitch-black forest. But he made a small noise of appraisal and lifted my chin to look.
All the colours of the earth, he said,
and smoothed the hair from my face.
But here, all about your face, it's the colour of moonlight, Mugrai.
Chapter 55. The Venom of the North Wind. Rachel woke suddenly, completely, alert, but with no idea what had woken her. She moved, turning her head to see if Ian was awake. He was, his hand clamped across her mouth, and she froze. It was dark in the cabin, but there was light enough from the banked fire for her to see his face, eyes dark with warning. She blinked once, and with a tiny nod he removed his hand. He lay quite still, and so did she. Though her heart thumped hard enough that she thought it would wake Oggie, snuggled between them. Thumping hard enough that she couldn't hear anything either. Ian was listening, though. His long body hadn't moved, and yet he seemed to have coiled up somehow like a snake gathering itself. She shut her eyes, concentrating. There had been wind all night. Berries from the big red cedar that guarded the house had been thumping on the roof at intervals. But Ian would have recognized that sound. Suddenly Ian moved. Rising onto one elbow, she heard him breathe in sharply and by reflex did the same. Tobacco. In the next instant he'd slid out of bed and padded naked to the door. She let out her breath with a sense of relief. A friend, then. Soft voices on the porch. Then Ian stuck his head back in, smiled briefly at her, and snatching a folded blanket from the top of the chest, closed the door behind him. Oggie, disturbed by the sense of movement, stirred and made snuffling noises. She rose with haste in order to make use of the chamber pot before he roused all the way. He wasn't a patient child. Her shawl round her shoulders and the baby at her breast, she stole up to the window by the door. It was covered with an oiled hide, tacked down against drafts, so she couldn't see anything, but sounds came through from the porch fairly well. Not that it did her much good. The visitors, she made out at least two different voices, besides Ian's, were Indians, and speaking in their own language. Perhaps Standing Heron Bradshaw and a friend from the Cherokee villages come to help hunt the catamount that had been seen near the creek. That was a merciful thought. The more men there were, the safer they'd be, presumably. She was just about to go and check the porridge in the pot in case the visitors needed breakfast, when she heard a word that froze her in her tracks and made her squeeze Oggie so hard that he emitted a small surprised poof and stopped feeding for an instant. He latched onto her breast again with instant ferocity, but she barely noticed. Not Cherokee, not at all. They were Mohawk, and the word that had caught her ear was Wakuteosnonsa. She didn't wait to put the child down or dress. When she stepped out onto the porch, the boards were icy under her bare feet and the light was just beginning to fade into view. So were the interested faces of not two, but three Mohawks, all of whom looked at her and nodded politely. One of them said something that made Ian cough and glance sideways at her. He was wearing the blanket wrapped around his waist, and the sight of his bare chest, The nipples, gone small and hard with cold, made her own nipples do something in sympathy that made Oggy choke and cough, sputtering milk all down the front of her shift. The Indians looked away as though nothing had happened.
"Thy friends are welcome, Ian," she said, trying not to grit her teeth. She smiled at them. "Will they eat with us?"
They understood English, for all three at once went into the cabin. Ian made to follow them, and she grabbed his arm with her free hand.
"What's happened?" she said, low-voiced.
"A massacre," he said.
And she saw now that he was upset, his face tight with worry.
"There was an attack on a settlement, only a few houses, but all Whigs. It was Joseph Brant and some of his men. But then some fighters from Burke Hollow made a raid on a Mohawk settlement, in revenge."
He tried to turn toward the door, but she tightened her grip enough to stay him, not caring if she bruised him. "Thy wife," she said. "I see they came to give thee news of her. Was she in that settlement? Does she live?" He didn't want to answer, but to his credit he did.
"I dinna ken. She was alive when Looks at the Moon saw her, but that was near 5 months ago."
His eyes shifted past her, and she knew he was looking toward the peak of the distant mountain, where a faint dusting of snow had appeared a week before. Works with her hands and her children were far to the north. How far? She wondered, and drew the shawl over Oggy's round, bare head. Looks at the Moon swallowed the last of his turkey hash and gave a loud belch of appreciation in Rachel's direction, then handed her his plate before resuming the story he had been telling between bites. Fortunately, it was mostly in Mohawk, as the parts that had been in English appeared to deal with one of his cousins, who had suffered following an encounter with an enraged moose. Rachel took the plate and refilled it, envisioning the light of Christ glowing within their guests. Owing to an orphaned and penurious childhood, she had had considerable practice in such discernment, and was able to smile pleasantly at Moon as she placed the newly filled plate at his feet, not to interrupt his gesticulations. On the good side, she reflected, glancing into the cradle, the men's conversation had lulled Oggy into a stupor. With a glance that caught Ian's eye and a nod toward the cradle, she went out to enjoy a mother's rarest pleasure, 10 minutes alone in the privy. Emerging relaxed in body and mind, she was disinclined to go back into the cabin. She thought briefly of walking down to the big house to visit Claire, but Jenny had gone down herself when it had become apparent that the newly arrived Mohawks would spend the night at the Murray's cabin. Rachel was very fond of her mother-in-law, but then she adored Oggy and loved Ian madly, and she really didn't want the company of any of them just now. The evening was cold but not bitter, and she had a thick woolen shawl. A gibbous moon was rising amid a field of glorious stars, and the peace of heaven seemed to breathe from the autumn forest, pungent with conifers and the softer scent of dying leaves. She made her way carefully up the path that led to the well, paused for a drink of cold water, and then went on, coming out a quarter hour later on the edge of a rocky outcrop that gave a view of endless mountains and valleys by day. By night, it was like sitting on the edge of eternity. Peace seeped into her soul with the chill of the night, and she sought it, welcomed it. But there was still an unquiet part of her mind, and a burning in her heart, at odds with the vast quiet that surrounded her. Ian would never lie to her. He'd said so, and she believed him. But she wasn't fool enough to think that meant he told her everything she might want to know. And she very much wanted to know more about Wakio Tea Snownsa, the Mohawk woman Ian had called Emily, and loved. So now she was perhaps alive, perhaps not. If she did live, what might be her circumstances? For the first time, it occurred to her to wonder how old Emily might be and what she looked like. Ian hadn't ever said. She hadn't ever asked. It hadn't seemed important, but now. Well,
When she found him alone, she would ask, that's all. And with determination, she turned her face to the moon and her heart to her inner light and prepared to wait. It was maybe an hour later when the darkness near her moved and Ian was suddenly there beside her, a warm spot in the night.
Is Oggie awake? She asked, drawing her shawl around her.
Nay, lass, he's sleeping like a stone.
And thy friends?
Much the same. I gave them a bit of Uncle Jamie's whisky.
How very hospitable of thee, Ian.
That wasn't exactly my intention, but I suppose I should take credit for it, if it makes you think more highly of me.
He brushed the hair behind her ear, bent his head, and kissed the side of her neck, making his intention clear. She hesitated for the briefest instant, but then ran her hand up under his shirt and gave herself over, lying back on her shawl beneath the star-strewn sky.
Let it be just us once more, she thought. If he thinks of her, let him not do it now.
And so it was that she didn't ask what Emily looked like until the Mohawks finally left, 3 days later. Ian didn't pretend not to know why she asked.
Small, he said, holding his hand about 3 inches above his elbow.
4 inches shorter than I.
Neat, with a pretty face.
If she is beautiful, Ian, he may say so, Rachel said dryly. I am a friend. We aren't given to vanity.
He looked at her, his lips twitching a little. Then he thought better of whatever he'd been about to say. He closed his eyes for an instant, then opened them, and answered her honestly.
She was lovely. I met her by the water, a pool in the river where the water spreads out, and there's not even a ripple on the surface, but you feel the spirit of the river moving through it just the same.
He'd seen her standing thigh-deep in the water, clothed, but with her shirt drawn up and tied round her waist with a red scarf, holding a thin spear of sharpened wood and watching for fish.
I canna think of her in her parts, he said, his voice a little husky. What her eyes looked like, her face.
He made an odd, graceful little gesture with his hand, as though he cupped Wakio Tea Snownsa's cheek, then travelled the line of her neck and shoulder.
I only when I think of her.
He glanced at her and made a noise in his throat.
I think of her now and then, not often, but when I do, I only think of her as all of a piece, and I cannot tell you in words what that looks like.
Why should thee not think of her? Rachel said, as gently as she could. She was thy wife, the mother of your children?
Aye, he said softly,
and bent his head. Emily had borne him one stillborn daughter and miscarried 2 more babes. Rachel thought she might have chosen her place better. They were in the shed that served as a small barn, and there was a farrowing sow in a pen right in front of them, 12 fat piglets thrusting and grunting at her teats, a testament to fecundity.
I need to tell you something, Rachel, he said, raising his head abruptly.
Thee knows thee can tell me anything, Ian, she said, and meant it. But her heart meant something different, and began to beat faster.
Emily's children. I told you I'd met them when I saw her last. The 2 young ones, she had those by Sun Elk, but the eldest, the boy.
He hesitated.
She asked me to name the baby. That's a great honour, he explained. But something made me name the boy instead. I called him Swiftest of Lizards. He was catching lizards when I met him, catching them in his hand. We got on, he said, and smiled briefly at the memory. I'm sorry, Rachel. I ken you'll think that's wrong, but I'm no sorry I did it.
I see, she said slowly, though she didn't. She was beginning to have a hollow feeling in her middle, though. So what thee is telling me is...
I think he's maybe mine, Ian blurted. The boy? He would have been born about the right time after I left. The thing is, Ken, I told you, the Mohawks say that when a man lies with a woman, his spirit fights with hers.
I wouldn't say they're wrong, but...
She flapped a hand, interrupting herself. Go on.
And if his spirit conquers hers, she'll get with child.
He put his arm round her,
his hand big and warm on her elbow.
So maybe Auntie Claire was wrong about the things in the blood. I mean, our wee man is fine. Maybe it was Emily's blood that...
Aye, well.
He bent his head and rested it on hers, so they stood forehead to forehead, eye to eye.
I dinna ken, Rachel, he said quietly, but...
We have to go,
she said, though her heart had gone so small she could barely feel its beating.
Of course,
we must go.
Chapter 56.
Thee would make a good friend.
Thee would make a good friend, thee knows, Rachel remarked, holding back a laurel branch for her mother-in-law, who was burdened by a large basket of quilting. Rachel herself was burdened with Oggy, who had fallen asleep in the sling she carried him in.
Janet Murray gave her a sharp look and made what Claire had privately described to Rachel as a Scottish noise, this being a mingled snort and gargling sound that might indicate anything from mild amusement or approval to contempt, derision, or impending forcible action. At the moment, Rachel thought her mother-in-law was amused and smiled herself.
"Thee is forthright and direct," Rachel pointed out, "and honest. Or at least, I suppose thee to be," she added, slightly teasing. "I can't say I have ever caught thee in a lie."
"Wait until you kent me a bit longer, lass, before you make judgments like that," Jenny advised her. "I'm a fine wee liar when the need arises. What else, though?"
Her dark blue eyes creased a little, definitely amusement. Rachel smiled back and thought for a moment, threading her way over a steep patch of gravel where the trail had washed out, then reaching back to take the basket.
"He is compassionate, kind, and fearless," she said, watching Jenny come down, half-sliding and grabbing branches to keep erect.
Her mother-in-law's head turned sharply, eyes wide.
"Fearless," she said incredulous. "Me?"
She made a noise that Rachel would have spelled as,
"Psh." "I've been scared to the bone since I was 10 years old, Lennon. But you get used to it, Ken."
She took back the basket, and Rachel hoisted Oggy, whose weight had doubled the moment he fell asleep, into a more secure position.
"What happened when thee was 10?
She asked, curious.
"My mother died," Jenny answered.
Her expression and voice were both matter-of-fact, but Rachel could hear bereavement in it, plain as the high, thin call of a hermit thrush.
"Mine died when I was born," Rachel said after a long pause. "I can't say that I miss her, as I never knew her, though of course..."
"They say you canna miss what you've never had, but they're wrong about that one," Jenny said, and touched Rachel's cheek with the palm of her hand, small and warm. "Watch where you're walking, lass. It's slick underfoot."
"Yes."
Rachel kept her eyes on the ground, striding wide to avoid a muddy patch where a tiny spring bubbled up.
"I dream sometimes. There's a woman, but I don't know who she is. Perhaps it is my mother. She seems kind, but she doesn't say much. She just looks at me."
"Does she look like you, lass?"
Rachel shrugged, balancing Oggy with a hand under his bottom.
"She has dark hair, but I can't ever remember her face when I wake up."
"And you wouldn't have ken what she looked like alive?"
Jenny nodded, looking at something behind her own eyes.
"I kent mine, and if you ever want to know what she looked like, just go and have a keek at Brianna, for she's Ellen Mackenzie Fraser to the life, though a wee bit bigger."
"I'll do that," Rachel assured her.
She found her new cousin-in-law slightly intimidating, though Ian clearly loved her.
"Scared, though, and thee said thee has been frightened ever since."
She didn't think she'd ever met someone less frightened than Janet Murray, whom she'd seen only yesterday face down a huge raccoon on the cabin's porch,
driving it off with a broom, and a Scottish execration, in spite of the animal's enormous claws and menacing aspect. Jenny glanced at her, surprised, and changed the heavy basket from one arm to the other with a small grunt as the trail narrowed.
"Oh, no scared for myself, and Ian. I dinna think I've ever worried about being killed or the like. No, scared for them. Scared I wouldn't be able to manage to take care of them."
"Them?" "Jamie and Da," Jenny said, frowning a little at the squashy ground under her feet. It had rained hard the night before, and even the open ground was muddy. "I dinna ken how to take care of them. I kent well I couldna fill my mother's place for either one. See, I thought they'd die without her."
"And you'd be left entirely alone," Rachel thought, "wanting to die too, and not knowing how.
It does seem much easier for men. I wonder why. Do they not think anyone needs them?"
"They manage, though," she said, and Jenny shrugged.
"I put on her apron and made their supper. That was all I kent to do, feed them."
"I suppose that was the most important thing."
She bent her head and brushed the top of Oggy's cap with her lips. His mere presence made her breasts tingle and ache. Jenny saw that and smiled in a rueful sort of way.
"Aye, when you hae bairns, there's that wee time when you really are all they need. And then they leave your arms and you're scared all over again, because now you ken all the things that could harm them, and you not able to keep them from it."
Rachel nodded, and they made their way in silence, through a close, listening sort of silence, through the little oak wood and round the edge of the smaller hayfield, to the growth of aspens where the cabin stood. She had thought she'd leave it to Ian to tell his mother, but the mood between them was one of love, and the spirit moved her to speak now.
"Ian means to go to New York," she said.
Oggy was stirring, and she hoisted him to her shoulder, patting his firm little back.
"To satisfy himself regarding the welfare of
the Indian woman he was wed to," Jenny said bluntly.
"Aye, I thought he'd want to when I heard about the massacre."
Rachel didn't waste time asking how Jenny had heard about it. The Mohawks had stayed 3 days, and news of any kind seeped through the ridge like indigo dye through a wet cloth.
"I will go with him," she said.
Jenny made a noise that might be spelled grumph, but nodded.
"Aye, I thought you might."
"You did?" Rachel was surprised and perhaps a little affronted. She had expected shock and argument, attempted dissuasion.
"He's told you about his dead bairns by her, I expect."
"He did, yes, before we wed." Oggy's live weight in her arms was a double blessing. She knew how much Ian had feared never being able to sire a live child. Jenny nodded.
"He's an honest man, and kind to boot. But I doubt he'll ever make a decent friend."
"Well, so do I," Rachel admitted. "And yet miracles happen." That made Jenny laugh. She stopped at the edge of the porch and put down her basket in order to scrape the mud from the soles of her shoes, then held Rachel's elbow to balance her while she did the same.
"Fearless, she said," Jenny said meditatively. "Friends are fearless, are they?"
"We don't fear death because we think our lives are lived only in preparation for eternal life with God," Rachel explained.
"Well, if the worst thing that can happen to you is death, and you're no afraid of that, well then," Jenny shrugged.
"I suppose you're right."
Her face crinkled suddenly and she laughed. "Fearless? I need to think on that one for a bit. Get used to it, Ken."
"Still," she lifted her chin, indicating Oggy, who'd roused at the scent of home and was rooting sleepily at Rachel's breast.
"Do you not fear for him, taking him all that way through a war?"
She didn't add, "Wouldn't losing him be worse than death?" But she didn't need to. Rachel unfastened her blouse and put Oggy to suck, drawing in her breath as he seized her nipple, then relaxing as her milk let down. Jenny was waiting for her, eyes fixed on Oggy's head. Rachel spoke evenly.
Would thee let thy husband go alone 700 miles to rescue his first wife and her 3 children, one of whom might just possibly be his? Jenny's mouth opened, but apparently there were no Scottish sounds appropriate to the occasion. Well, no, she said mildly. Thee has a point. Chapter 57 Ready for Anything. He'd have to tell her, and sooner rather than later. At least he'd got a plan made, whether she liked it or not. It was raining, and the solid drops pounded the tin roof of the goat shed like gunfire. Ian ducked inside to find his mother milking one of the nannies and singing a walking song at the top of her lungs. She glanced up at him, nodded to indicate that she'd be with him in a wee bit, and went on singing 1,000 curses on love and milking. The goats looked up at him too, but recognized him and went on munching their grass with nothing more than a twitch of an ear. They seemed to be enjoying the song. They weren't agitated by the rain or the thunder in the distance, but growing steadily louder. His mother stripped off the udder with a wee flourish and concluded with, "A girl!" Ian applauded, which startled all the goats into a belated chorus of meh. "Hark at ye, you wee gomeral," his mother said, but in a tolerant tone. She rose, loosed the goat from the stanchion, and picked up the brimming pail. "Here, carry this into the house, but tell Rachel not to churn it till the storm passes. I dinna ken if she knows you mustn't churn during thunder. The butter won't come."
"I think she kens well enough that you dinna want to stand on the front stoop doing it while the rain's pissing down, even if you weren't like to be struck by lightning." "Pfft," she said, and pulled her shawl up over her head.
No sooner had she done so, though, than the rain changed abruptly to hail.
"Dinna go out there, you'll be brained," she said, making the horns.
She might have added something about the quality of his brain, but it was impossible to hear a word. Hailstones, the size of pig's knuckles, were thundering on the tin roof, bouncing and rolling on the green grass outside the open shed. He set the pail down by the wall, where it wouldn't be kicked over, and raising a brow at his mother, crossed his arms and leaned against one of the timbers, prepared to wait. He'd worked himself up for this, and he wasn't doing it over again. Do it and have it done. There wasn't time to haver. The goats, goat-like, wandered over to him and began to nose him familiarly for anything loose. But aside from his shirt tail, which he'd already gathered up in his hand, there was nothing to attract them. Despite the open front of the shed and the cold breath of the passing storm, it was pleasantly warm amongst the inquisitive, hairy bodies, and he felt his anxiety over the coming conversation subsiding a bit. His mother came over to stand by the goat nosing his buttocks, and stood gazing contentedly out at the storm, scratching the goat between the ears. It was a fine view, to be sure. She'd chosen the site for her goat shed, and he'd built it so she could look out through a wide gap in the trees and see Roan Mountain in the distance, very dramatic at the moment, its top disappearing into lowering black clouds that sparked and spat lightning. As they watched, a huge thunderbolt split both sky and air, and he and the goats all jerked back at the dazzling crash. As though the lightning had been a signal, though, the hail abruptly stopped, and the rain resumed more quietly than before. "It looks like the Mackenzie's badge, no?" his mother remarked, nodding at the distant mountain. "Fires all over it." There were, in fact, 3 small plumes of smoke rising from the lower slopes where the lightning had struck something flammable. "Nay, bother, with this much rain they wouldn't burn long enough to matter."
"I've never seen a Mackenzie badge," he said. "A mountain, is it? With fires?"
She glanced up at him, momentarily surprised, but then nodded. "Aye, I was forgetting. All that was gone before you could walk." Her mouth tightened, but only for a moment. "Did your da ever tell you the Murray's motto?"
"Aye, but I didn't remember much. Something about fetters, was it?"
"Firth, fortune, and fill the fetters," she said succinctly,
Go ye out, and make sure to come back with gold and captives.
That made him laugh.
A warlike lot, were they? The old Murrays?
She shrugged.
Not as I ever noticed, but Ken, your dad did go for a mercenary when he was a young man, and your Uncle Jimmy, too.
Her mouth twitched.
I'm sure Jimmy's told you the Fraser motto more than once. Je suis prêt.
He has. Ian smiled a little ruefully.
I am ready.
His mother smiled at that, glancing up at him. The shawl had slipped back to her shoulders, and her bound hair glowed like polished steel in the rainlight.
Aye, well, there's a second Murray motto. The first was made by the Duke of Athol. Bloodthirsty old creature, but the second one's better. Tout prêt.
Quite ready, or ready for anything.
Both.
I thought of that now and then, whilst they were gone away to France.
Je suis prêt, tout prêt. And every night I'd pray to the Virgin that they were ready, I mean.
She fell silent, her hand resting on the goat's brown and white head.
He'd not find a better moment. He coughed. As for being ready, ma'am.
She caught the note in his voice and looked at him sharply.
Aye? I've spoken to Barney Chisholm. You'll be welcome to stay with him and Christina whilst we're gone, Rachel and me, he added, swallowing. We're going up into the north to see about
your Indian wife, she asked dryly.
Dinna trouble yourself. I've already asked the MacDonald lassies to care for the goats.
You what?
He felt as though she'd stuck out a foot and hooked his legs out from under him. She gave him a look of mild exasperation.
You dinna think I'd let Rachel follow you alone through a war, and her with that lolloping great bairn of yours.
But... The words died in his throat.
He kent his mother well enough to see that she meant it. And no matter what the Frasers said their motto was, he kept fine, and it might as well have been stubborn as a rock. He'd seen that look on Uncle Jamie's face often enough to recognise it now.
Besides, she added, pushing the goat's nose away from the fringe of her shawl,
I dinna suppose you'll find much goo with a mohawk, but I'd just as soon you didn't end up in fetters yourself in a red coat prison.
There wasn't much to do but laugh. He had one last try, though, just so he could tell his da he had.
Do you think Da would let you go do such a daft thing?
I didn't see that he'd have much room to talk, she said with a one-shouldered shrug. Here, take this one. She handed over the full pail and bent for the other one. Besides, he wouldn't try to stop me. We Oggies his blood as much as mine. Ian Moore will be right there with me, all the way.
Ian swallowed a wee lump in his throat, but felt curiosity along with remembered grief.
You feel Da by ye? He asked.
I do, sometimes.
His mother gave him the second pail and opened the gate across the front of the shed. The rain had let up, and the air shimmered round them, silver in the greyness.
You dinna stop loving someone just because they're dead, she said reprovingly. I canna suppose they stop loving you either.
How old is thy mother? Rachel said to Ian. I'd welcome her company, and to have help with the bairn would be a great relief, but thee knows better than I do what such a journey may be like.
Ian grinned, not at the question, but at the way she said bairn, hesitating for an instant before saying it, as though afraid it might get away before she could clap a lid over it.
I dinna ken for sure, he said in answer to her question. She's 2 years the elder of Uncle Jamie, though.
Oh, her face eased a bit at that.
And it's barely a year since she left Scotland and came with Uncle Jamie all the way across the ocean, and then making their way hundreds of miles cross-country to Philadelphia. This journey may be a bit longer. He coughed a little, thinking, and just a bit more dangerous. But we'll have good horses, and enough money for inns, where there are any.
Besides, he said, shrugging,
she says she's coming with us.
So she is.
Chapter 58 Telling Beads. Jamie didn't bother walking softly. Bears weren't afraid of anything, and it would likely be chance alone that determined who saw whom first. The shadows that overlay the trail to the upper meadow they called Fir Mealish were still black with the night's cold. The yellowing trees that edged the path were slick and heavy with last night's rain, and Jamie had pulled his plaid up over his head to keep the drips out. Old and worn as his plaid was, it was still warm and still shed water.
"I should have told Claire I want to be buried in it if a bear gets the better of me. It'll be cosy against the grave damp."
But then he thought of Amy Higgins and crossed himself. He came out of the shadows into the high meadow, misty in the early morning. Three does grazing on the far side looked up at him, startled by the intrusion, then disappeared with a crash of shrubbery. That answered one question, then. No bears were nearby. At this time of year, a bear likely wouldn't bother with deer. The streams teemed with fish, and the woods were still full of everything a bear thought tasty, from grubs and mushrooms to bee trees full of honey. And he did hope his present quarry might have found one of those recently. It gave a faint, soft smell to the grease. But deer had very set opinions of carnivores in general, and didn't pause to reckon the odds when one showed up. He quartered the meadow, then walked slowly round the edge looking for bear sign, but found nothing more than a crumbled pile of old droppings under a pine and claw marks on a big alder, made recently, but the sap had dried hard. Joe had seen a bear in the meadow 5 days ago, he said. Clearly it hadn't been back since. Jamie stood still for a moment, lifting his face to the breeze that stirred the grass tops. A faint tang on the air. Not bear. A buck deer close by, not yet in full rut, but interested in the does. More crashing made him turn, but the eager chorus of meh's told him who it was long before his sister came up over the lip of the trail with four young nanny goats on a long rope. She had a gun over her shoulder, and was looking keenly round.
"And what do you mean to do with that, a pure?" he asked conversationally.
She hadn't seen him in the shadows, and swung round, startled. The fowling piece pointed straight at him. He took a hasty step to the side, just in case it should be loaded.
"Dinner shoot? As me?"
"Gomeral," she said, lowering her gun. "What do you mean, what do I mean to do with it? How many things can you do with a gun?"
"Well, if you're after bear, I think your piece might give him a nosebleed, but not much more," he said, nodding at the gun in her hand.
His own rifle was still slung on his shoulder, loaded and primed. Not that it would likely stop a charging bear, but if the creature was only suspicious, a shot might make it keep its distance.
"Bear? Oh, is that what you're up to?" Claire wondered.
She loosed the eager goats, and they dived headfirst into the thick grass like ducks in a millpond.
"Did she, then?"
He kept his voice casual.
"She didn't see so," his sister said frankly, "but she saw your gun was gone while we were making breakfast, and she stopped dead, only for an instant."
His heart squeezed a little. He hadn't wanted to wake Claire when he left in the dark. But he should have told her last night that he meant to see if he could get upon the trail of the bear Joe Beardsley had seen. There'd been little time for hunting while they worked to get the roof raised before winter. They needed the meat and grease badly. Besides, they had only a few quilts and one woolen trade blanket he'd got from a Moravian trader. A good bear rug would be a comfort to Claire in the deep cold nights. She felt the cold more now than the last time they'd spent a winter on the ridge.
"She's all right," his sister added, and he felt her interested gaze on his own face. "She only wondered, Ken."
He nodded, wordless. It might be a wee while yet before Claire could wake to find him gone out with a gun and think nothing of it. He took a breath and saw it wisp out white, vanishing instantly, though the new sun was already warm on his shoulders.
"Aye? And what are you doing up here yourself? It's a far piece to walk for forage."
One of the goats had come up for air and was nosing the hanging end of his leather belt in an interested manner. He tucked it up out of reach and kneed the goat gently away. "I'm fattening them to stand the winter," she said, nodding at the nosy nanny. "Maybe breed them if they're ready. They like the grass better than the forage in the woods, and it's easier to keep an eye on them."
"You ken well enough Fanny would mind them for you. Is wee Oggy driving you mad?"
The baby had vigorous lungs. You could hear him at the big house when the wind was right.
"Or are you driving Rachel mad yourself?"
"I like goats," she said, ignoring his question, and shoving aside a pair of questing lips nibbling after the fringe of her shawl. "Sheep are good-hearted things when they're not trying to knock you over, but they're no bright. A goat has a mind of its own."
"Aye, and so do you. Ian always said you liked the goats because they're just as stubborn as you are."
She gave him a long, level look. "Pot," she said succinctly.
"Kettle," he replied, flicking a plucked grass stem toward her nose.
She grabbed it out of his hand and fed it to the goat.
"Mm-hmm," she said. "Well, if you must know, I come up here to think now and then, and pray."
"Why?"
he said. But she pressed her lips together for a moment, and then turned to look across the meadow, shading her eyes against the slant of the morning sun.
"Well enough," he thought. "She'll say whatever it is when she's ready."
"There's a bear up here, is there?" she asked, turning back to him. "Shall I take the goats back down?"
"Not likely. Joe Beardsley saw it a few days ago here in the meadow, but there's no fresh sign."
Jenny thought that over for a moment, then sat down on a lichened rock, spreading her skirts out neatly. The goats had gone back to their grazing, and she raised her face to the sun, closing her eyes. "Only a fool would hunt a bear alone," she said, her eyes still closed. "Claire told me that last week."
"Did she?"
he said dryly.
"Did she tell you the first time I killed a bear? I did it alone with my dirk. And she hit me in the head wi' a fish whilst I was doing it."
She opened her eyes and gave him a look. "She didn't say a fool canna be lucky," she pointed out, "and if he didn't have the luck of the devil himself, he'd have been dead 6 times over by now."
"Six?"
He frowned, disturbed, and her brow lifted in surprise.
"I wasn't really counting," she said. "It was only a guess."
"What is it, Sir Gray?" That casual, "Oh, love," caught him unexpectedly in a tender place, and he coughed to hide it.
"Nothing," he said, shrugging. "Only, when I was young in Paris, a fortune-teller told me I'd die 9 times before my death. Do you think I should count the fever after Lyra shot me?"
She shook her head definitely.
"Nay, you wouldn't have died even had Claire not come back wi' her wee needle. You would have got up and gone after her within a day or two."
He smiled.
"I might have."
His sister made a small noise in her throat that might have been laughter or derision. They were silent for a moment, both with heads lifted, listening to the wood. The dripping had ceased now, and you could hear a tree pie close by with a call exactly like a rusty hinge opening. Then there was a loud quack, quack, as a bird called from somewhere behind him, and he saw Jenny look up over his shoulder, wide-eyed.
"Is that a magpie?" she said.
In the Highlands you always listened for magpies, because they were omen birds, and if you heard one, you hoped to hear another. One for sorrow, 2 for mirth.
"No," he said, reassuring. "I dinna think there are proper magpies in these mountains. There's no but a kind of yaffle.
Aye, see him there?"
He nodded, and she looked over her shoulder to the greyish bird with a scarlet slash at its throat, clinging to a swaying pine branch, a beady eye fixed on the ground. Jenny relaxed and drew breath, and taking up the conversation where she'd left it, asked, "Do you hold it against me that I made you marry Lyra?" He gave her a look.
"What makes you think you could make me do anything I didn't want to do, you wee fuss budget?"
"What the devil is a fuss budget?" she demanded, frowning up at him.
"A bag of nuisance, so far as I can tell," he admitted. "Jimmy calls Mandy that."
A sudden dimple appeared near Jenny's mouth, but she didn't actually laugh. "Hi," she said.
You ken what I mean?
I do, he said,
and I don't.
Hold it against you, I mean. She didn't actually kill me, after all.
One of the goats squatted a few feet away and let fall a dainty shower of neat black pellets. They steamed briefly, and he caught the oddly pleasant warm scent for an instant before it vanished in the chill.
I wonder how it is goats are so neat about it, Jenny said, watching too. Compared with coos, I mean.
Oh, you'd want to be asking Claire about that, he told her. If it's a matter of innards, she cares nearly as much as God about it.
Jenny laughed, and he realized, belatedly, that he'd seen no goat droppings at all in his survey of the meadow. She hadn't been bringing her nannies up here regularly then, and therefore she'd come after him on purpose. She had a thing to tell him, maybe, in private. He cleared his throat and touched his chest where the wooden rosary hung beneath his shirt.
Pray, you said. Do you want to tell the beads together, then, like we used to?
She looked surprised, and for a moment dubious, but then made up her mind and nodded, reaching into her pocket.
Aye, I would. And since you mention...
There was a thing I meant to ask you, Jimmy.
Aye, what?
To his surprise, she drew out a string of gleaming pearls, the gold crucifix and medal bright in the rising sun.
You brought your good rosary, he asked. I dinna ken that. Thought you'd have left it for one of your lasses.
Good was putting it lightly. That rosary had been made in France and likely cost as much as a good saddle horse, if not more. It was their mother's rosary. Brian had given it to Jenny when he'd given Ellen's pearl necklace to Jamie. His sister grimaced and looked halfway apologetic.
If I gave it to anyone or them, the other would take it amiss. I didn't want them to be fighting over such a thing.
Aye, you're right about that.
He squatted down by her, reached out a finger, and gently touched the softly bumpy little beads. It was made of Scotch pearls, like the necklace he'd given Claire.
Where did Mam get it, do you know? I never thought to ask when I was wee.
Well, you wouldn't, would you? When you're wee, Mam and Da are just Mam and Da, and everything's just what it's always been.
She gathered the beads up into the palm of her hand, shuggling them into a little pile.
I do ken where this came from, though. Da told me when he gave it to me.
Do you think that doe's coming in heat?
She squinted suddenly at one of the nanny goats who had raised her head and let out a long, piercing bleat. Jamie gave the animal an eye.
Aye, maybe. She's waggling her tail, but it's maybe just she smells the buck deer in yonder grove.
He lifted his chin at the grove of sugar maples, gone half scarlet already, though none of the leaves had fallen. It's early for rut, but if I can smell him, so can she. His sister lifted her face to the light breeze and breathed in deep.
Aye, I didn't smell anything, but I'll take your word. Da always said you had a nose like a truffle pig.
He snorted.
Aye, right. So what did Da say to you then, about Mam's rosary?
Aye, well, he was jealous, he said. She would never see who sent her the necklace, Ken.
Oh, aye, do you know?
She shook her head, looking interested.
You do?
I do.
A man named Marcus MacRannoch, one of her suitors from Leoch, and a gallant man. He'd bought them for her, hoping to wed her. But she saw Da was at war with him before MacRannoch could speak to her. He said, well, Claire said he said.
He corrected that he'd thought of them so often around her bonny neck, he couldn't think of them anywhere else. And so sent them to her for a wedding present.
Jenny rounded her lips in interest.
Oh, so that's the way of it.
Well, Da kent it was another man, and as I say, he said he was jealous. They hadn't been married long, and he maybe wasn't quite sure she thought she'd made a good bargain taking up with him. So he sold a good field to Geordie McCallum, aye, and gave the money to Myrta to go and buy a wee bobby for Mam. He meant to give it her when the babe was born. Wally, aye?
She lifted the crucifix and kissed it gently in blessing of their brother.
God only knows where Murtagh got this.
She poured the rosary from one hand to the other with a slithering sound.
But the words on the medal are French. Murtagh.
Jamie glanced at the beads and furrowed his brow a bit.
But Da must have kent how he felt about her, about Mam.
Jenny nodded, rubbing a thumb over the crucifix and the beautifully sculpted, tortured body of Christ. The Yaffle called, faint and distant, beyond the maple grove.
He could see I thought the same thing. Why would he send Murtagh on such an errand?
But he said he hadn't meant to, only he told Murtagh what was in his mind, and Murtagh asked to go.
Da said he didn't want to let him, but he couldn't have very well go off himself and leave Mam about to burst with Willie, and not even a solid roof over her head yet.
He'd laid the cornerstones and started the chimneys, but nae more.
And, she lifted one shoulder, he loved Murtagh too, more than his ain brother. God, I miss the old bugger, Jamie said impulsively.
Jenny glanced at him and smiled ruefully.
So do I. I wonder sometimes if he's with them now, Mam and Da.
That notion startled Jamie. He'd never thought of it, and he laughed, shaking his head.
Well, if he is, I suppose he's happy.
I hope that's the way of it, Jenny said, growing serious. I always wished he could have been buried with them, with a family, at Lallybroch.
Jamie nodded, his throat suddenly tight. Murtagh lay with the fallen of Culloden, burnt and buried in some anonymous pit on that silent moor, his bones mingled with the others. No cairn for those who loved him to come and leave a stone to say so. Jenny laid a hand on his arm, warm through the cloth of his sleeve.
"Dinna mind it, Abraha," she said softly. "He had a good death, and you with him at the end." How would you know it was a good death?
Emotion made him speak more roughly than he meant, but she only blinked once, and then her face settled again.
You told me, Egypt, she said dryly, several times. Do you not recall that?
He stared at her for a moment, uncomprehending.
I told you. How? I dinna ken what happened.
Now it was her turn to be surprised.
You've forgotten?
She frowned at him.
Aye, well, it's true you were off your head, wee fever, for a good 10 days when they brought you home. Ian and I took it in turn to sit with you, as much to stop the doctor taking your leg off as anything else. You can thank Ian you've still got that one, she added, nodding sharply at his left leg. He sent the doctor away, said he kent well you'd rather be dead.
Her eyes filled abruptly with tears and she turned away. He caught her by the shoulder and felt her bones, fine and light as a kestrel's, under the cloth of her shawl.
Jenny, he said softly, Ian didn't want to be dead, believe me. I did, aye, but not him.
No.
He did at first, she said, and swallowed. But you wouldn't have let him, you said.
And he wouldn't have let you either.
She wiped her face with the back of her hand, roughly. He took hold of it and kissed it, her fingers cold in his hand.
You didn't think you had anything to do with it,
he asked, rising to his feet and smiling down at her,
for either of us.
Hmm, she said, but she looked modestly pleased.
The goats had moved away a little, brown backs smooth amid the tussocked grass. One of them had a bell. He could hear the small clank of it as she moved. The Yaffles had moved off as well. He caught the flash of scarlet as one flew low across the field and disappeared into the black mouth of the trail. He let a moment go by, two, and then shifted his weight and made a small menacing noise in the back of his throat.
Aye, aye, Jenny said, rolling her eyes at him. Of course I'll tell you. I had to fettle my mind first, Ken.
She rearranged her skirts and settled herself more firmly.
Hey then, this is the way of it, as you told it to me at least. You said,
her brows drew together with the effort of careful remembrance,
that you'd fought your way across the field in a fury, and when you stopped because you had to breathe, you were
dismayed to find you weren't dead yet.
Aye, he said softly, and with a deep sense of fear felt the day well up in him. Cold. It had been bitter cold in the wind and rain, but he'd been ablaze with the fighting. He hadn't felt it till he stopped. What then? That's what I dinna ken.
She drew a deep, audible breath. You were behind the government lines. There were cannon behind you, pointing the other way, aye, toward our men.
Aye, I could see. I could see them, lying dead and dying in windrows.
Windrows? She sounded a little startled, and he looked down, still feeling the chill of Culloden in his hands and feet.
They fell by lines, he said,
his own voice sounding remote and reasonable, detached.
The English guns, the muskets, they've a range of... I dinna mind it now, but that's where we fell, at the end of that range. There were men blown up and crushed by the cannon, but most of it was the muskets. Bayonets later. I heard that, didn't I see?
He swallowed, and keeping his voice steady, asked,
What did I see happen then?
She exhaled through her nose, and he saw she had closed her hand on the rosary, clenching it as though to draw strength from the beads.
You said you couldn't think what to do, but there was a cannon nearby, and the crew had their backs to you. So you turned to go after the nearest man, but there was a knot of redcoats between you and the cannon. And when you wiped the sweat out of your eyes, you saw one of them was Jack Randall.
Her free hand made an unobtrusive sign of the horns, then folded into a fist.
He remembered, and felt a lurch in his wame as the image he'd seen in dreams met and merged with memory. He saw me, he whispered. He stood stock still, and so did I. A shock of it. I couldn't make myself move.
And Murtaugh? Jenny's voice came soft.
I sent him back, he whispered, seeing his godfather's face creased in stubborn refusal. I made him go. Made him take Fergus and the others. I said he must see them safe to Lallybroch because...
Because...
Because you couldn't, she said, low-voiced. I couldn't, he said, and swallowed the growing lump in his throat. But he was there, you said, Jenny prompted after a moment. On the field. Murtaugh? Aye, he was.
He'd seen the sudden movement, a jerk of the frozen scene before him, and lifted his eyes from Jack Randall's face to look and see Murtaugh running. And once more the dream came down on him, and he was in it, cold. So cold the voice froze in his throat, rain and sweat plastering wet cloth to his body, and the icy wind cutting through his bones as easily as through his clothes. He had tried, to call out, to stop Murtaugh before he reached the English soldiers. But it would have taken more than muskets and British cannon to stop Murtaugh Fitzgibbon's Fraser, let alone Jamie's voice. And he didn't stop, bounding over the tumps of the moor grass, water bursting like broken glass under his feet as he went. Captain Randall spooked you said. Kill me.
He heard his own voice whisper the words. He asked me to kill him. My heart's desire.
The words lay like drops of lead in his ear. The wind had been whistling past his head, whipping the hair out of its binding and across his face. But he'd heard that. He knew he had. He hadn't dreamed it. But his eyes had been on Murtaugh. There was movement, confusion. Someone came toward him. He saw the dark blade of a bayonet wet with rain or blood or mud, and he pushed it aside, and suddenly it was a fight, with two of them pulling at him, bashing, trying to knock him down. A sudden sound surprised him, and he opened his eyes, disoriented, and realized that he'd made the noise. It was a sound he'd made when something took his left leg out from under him, a grunt of impact, impatience. he had to get up.
And Captain Randall reached down to you then, where you lay on the ground.
And I had my duck in my hand, and I...
He broke off and looked down at his sister, urgent.
Did I kill him? Did I see I did?
She was watching him closely, a look of deep concern on her face. He made an impatient gesture, and she gave him a reproving look.
No, she wouldn't lie to him. He kent better than that.
You said you did. You said it over and over.
I said I killed him over and over.
Despite herself, she gave a small shudder.
No.
That it was hot. The his blood. Hot, she kept saying. God, it was so hot.
Hot?
For a moment that made no sense, and then he caught a glimpse of it, the dim sense of darkness leaning over him, the brush of wet wool across his face, effort, so much effort to raise his arm one more time, trembling. He saw drops of clean rain run down the blade over his shaking hand, and effort, pushing, pushing up, and the thick, resisting, rasping cloth, momentary hardness. Push, God damn it! Then a deep, startling heat that had spilled over his frozen hand, his wind-chilled arm. He'd been desperately grateful for the warmth, he remembered that, but he couldn't remember the blow itself.
Murtaugh, he said,
and the sense of blood heat left him as suddenly as it had come, the chilly wind in his ears.
Did I see what happened to Murtaugh?
He gave a sigh of pain, exasperation, desolation.
Why would you not go when I told you, you scabbit old bugger?
He did, Jenny said unexpectedly. He took the men as far as the road and set them on their way. They said so when they came back to Lallybroch. But then he went back. For you.
For me.
He didn't have to close his eyes now. He saw it. He'd felt it in his own back, seeing the jolt of Murtaugh's knife up hard, aiming for the captain's kidneys. Randall had dropped like a rock.
Hadn't he?
But then, how was he standing later? And then the others were all on them. He'd been knocked flat onto his face and someone had stepped on his back, kicked him in the head, a gun butt had struck him in the ribs and knocked his breath out. There was shouting all around and the sense of ice was creeping up his body. Of course, he'd been badly wounded, but hadn't known it, was slowly bleeding to death. But all he could think of was Murtaugh, that he must reach Murtaugh. He'd crawled. He remembered seeing the water come up between his fingers as his hand pressed down, and the tough black prickle of wet heather as he grasped it, pulling himself along. His kilt was soaked from falling, heavy and dragging between his legs, hindering.
I found him, he said,
and took a breath that shook in his lungs.
Something happened. The soldiers were gone. I dinna ken how long it took, from one breath to the next is how it felt.
His godfather had been lying a few yards away from him, curled up like a babe asleep. But he hadn't been asleep.
Nor dead. Not yet.
Jamie had gathered him up in his arms, seen the terrible dented wound that had caved in his temple, the blood pumping black from a gash in his neck. But seen, too, the beauty, the lightning of Murtaugh's face as he opened his eyes to see Jamie holding him.
He told me it didn't hurt to die,
Jamie said. His voice was hoarse, and he cleared his throat.
He touched my face and said not to be afraid.
He'd remembered that, but now he remembered, too, the sense of sudden, overwhelming peace. The lightness, the exultation that had come back so strangely in his dream. Nothing mattered any longer. It was over. He'd bent his head and kissed Murtaugh's mouth, laid his own forehead against the bloody, tangled hair, and given up his soul to God.
But
he opened his eyes
didn't recall closing them, and turned to Jenny urgent.
But he came back, Randall. He wasn't dead. He came back.
Black. A black thing, man-shaped, upright against the sky, gone white and blind. Jamie's hands curled into fists so sudden the nails bit his palms.
He came back.
Jenny didn't speak and didn't move, but her eyes were fixed on him, urging him silently to remember. And he did. His limbs had gone weak, and he'd lost the feeling in his leg altogether. Without meaning it, he'd fallen to the ground, losing his hold on Morta's body. Was lying flat on his back, still able to feel rain on his face, but nothing else. His sight gone. He didn't care about the black man, about anything. The peace of death was upon him. Pain and fear had gone, and even hate had seeped away. He'd closed his eyes again now, seeing it, and imagined that he felt Murta's hand, hard and calloused, still holding his as they lay on the ground.
"Did I kill him?" he whispered, more to himself than to Jenny. "I did. I ken I did. But how?" "The blood. The hot blood. The blood. It spilled down my arm, and then I wasn't there anymore. But when I woke, my eyes were sealed shut with dried blood, and that's what made me think I was dead. I couldn't see anything but a sort of dark red light. But then later I couldn't find a wound on my head. It was his blood blinding me. And he was lying on me, on my leg."
He'd opened his eyes, still explaining it to himself, and found he was sitting on the ground, the calloused hand clinging tight to his was his sister's, and tears were running silently down her face as she watched him.
"Oh," he said, and rising to his knees, gathered her off her rock and into his arms. "Dinna weep, Lennon. It's over."
"That's what you think, is it?" she said, voice muffled in his shirt. She was right, he knew that, but she held him tight, and slowly, slowly the morning came back. They sat for a little while, not speaking. The sun had come well above the treetops by now, and while the air was still fresh and sweet, there was no longer any chill in it.
"I will," he said at last, standing up. "Do you still want to pray?"
For she still held the pearl rosary dangling from one hand. He didn't wait for her reply, but reached into his shirt and drew out the wooden rosary that he wore about his neck.
"Oh, you've got your old beads after all," she said, surprised. "You didn't have your rosary in Scotland, so I thought you'd lost it. Meant to make ye a new one, but there wasn't a time, what with Ian."
She lifted one shoulder, the gesture encompassing the whole of the terrible months of Ian's long dying. He touched the beads, self-conscious.
"I will. I had, in a way of speaking. I gave it to William when he was a wee lad, and I had to leave him at Hellwater. I gave him the beads for something to keep, to remember me by."
"Mm-hmm." She looked at him with sympathy.
"Aye,
and I expect he gave them back to you in Philadelphia, did he?"
"He did,"
Jamie said, a bit terse, and a wry amusement touched Jenny's face.
"Tell you one thing, Abraha, he's no going to forget you." "Aye, maybe not," he said, feeling an unexpected comfort in the thought. "Well, then."
He let the beads run through his fingers, taking hold of the crucifix.
"I believe in God, the Father Almighty."
They said the creed together, then the Our Father, and the three Hail Marys, and the Glory Be.
"Joyful or glorious?"
he asked, fingers on the first bead of the decades. He didn't want to do the sorrowful mysteries, the ones about suffering and crucifixion, and he didn't think she did either. A yaffle called from the maples, and he wondered briefly if it was one they'd already seen, or a third. Three for a wedding, four for a death.
"Joyful," she said at once, "the Annunciation."
Then she paused and nodded at him to take the first turn.
He didn't have to think.
For murder, he said quietly,
and his fingers tightened on the bead.
And Mam and Da. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Jenny finished the prayer, and then they said the rest of the decade in their usual way, back and forth, the rhythm of their voices soft as the rustle of grass. They reached the second decade, the visitation, and he nodded at Jenny. Her turn.
For Ian Oog, she said softly, eyes on her beads,
and Ian Moore.
Hail Mary.
The third decade was William's. Jenny glanced at him when he said so, but only nodded and bent her head. He didn't try to avoid thinking of William, but he didn't deliberately call the lad to mind either. There was nothing he could do to help until, or unless, William asked for it, and it would do neither of them good to worry about what the lad was doing or what might be happening to him.
But he'd said, William,
and for the space of an Our Father, 10 Hail Marys, and a Glory Be, William must perforce be in his mind.
Guide him, he thought between the words of the prayer. Give him good judgment. Help him to be a good man. Show him his way. And Holy Mother, keep him safe for your own son's sake. World without end, amen, he said, reaching the final bead.
For all those to him in Scotland, Jenny said without hesitation, then paused and looked up at him. Lyra too, do you think?
Aye, her too, he said, smiling despite himself, so long as you put in that poor bastard she's married to as well.
For the last decade, they paused for a moment, eyeing each other.
Well, the last was for the folk in Scotland, he said. Let's do this one for the folk elsewhere. Michael and wee Joan and Jared in France.
Jenny's face grew momentarily soft. She had not seen Michael since Ian's funeral, and the poor lad had been shattered. His young wife suddenly dead, a child gone with her. Then his father. Jenny's mouth trembled for an instant, but her voice was clear, and the sun lay soft on the white of her cap as she bent her head.
Our Father, who art in heaven.
There was silence when they finished, the sort of silence a wood gives you, made of wind and the sounds of drying grass and of trees shedding leaves in a yellow rain. The goat's bell clanked on the far side of the meadow, and a bird he didn't know chattered to itself in the maple grove. The buck deer was gone. He'd heard it leave sometime while he was praying for William, and he'd wished his son good fortune in the hunt. Jenny drew breath as though to speak, and he lifted a hand. There was something in his mind, and he'd best say it now.
What you said about Lallybroch, he began a little awkwardly. Don't be worried about it. If you should die before me, I'll see to it that you get home safe. To lie wi' Ian.
She nodded thoughtfully, but her lips were pursed a little as she held them when thinking.
Aye, I ken you would, Jeemie. You dinna need to go to great lengths about it, though. I don't.
She blew air out through her lips, then set them firmly.
Well, see, I dinna ken where I might be come the time. If it's here, then of course. Where the devil else might it be?
He demanded, with the dawning realization that she couldn't have come up here to tell him about Murtagh, because she hadn't known he needed telling, so... I'm going with Ian and Rachel to find his Mohawk wife, she said. As casually, she might have said she was off to pull turnips. Before he could find a single word, she held up the rosary in front of his face. I'm leaving this for you, Ken. It's for Mandy, just in case I dinna come back. You ken well enough what sort of things can happen when you're travelling, she added, with a small moo of disapproval.
Travelling, he said. Travelling? You mean to...
The thought of his sister, small, elderly and stubborn as an alligator sunk in the mud, marching north through two armies in dead of winter, beset by brigands, wild animals, and half a dozen other things he could think of, if he'd had time for it.
I do.
She gave him a look, indicating that she didn't mean to bandy words for long.
Where young Ian goes, Rachel says she's going too. And that means so does the wean. You didn't think I mean to leave my youngest grandchild to the mercies of bears and wild Indians, do you?
That's a rhetorical question, she added, with a pleased air of having put a stop to him.
That means I didn't expect you to answer it.
You wouldn't have ken a rhetorical question from a hole in the ground if I hadn't told you what one was.
Well then, you should recognise one when it bites you on the nose, she said, sticking her own lang neb up in the air.
I'll go and talk to Rachel, he said, eyeing her. Surely she's better sense than to...
You think I didn't? Or young Ian? Jenny shook her head half admiringly.
It would be easier to move yon wee mountain there, she nodded at the bulk of Roan Mountain, looming dark green in the distance, than to get that Quaker lass to change her mind once it's made up.
But the bairn?
Aye, she said a little irritably.
You think I didn't mention that?
And she did squinch her eyes a bit. But then she said to me, reasonable as Sunday, would I let my husband go alone 700 miles to rescue his first wife, and her wee three pitiable bairns, one of whom might just possibly be Ian's?
Ah, that's the first I heard of it too, she added, seeing his face.
I see her point.
Jesus.
Aye. She stretched herself, groaning a little, and shook her skirts, which were thick with foxtails by now. Jamie could feel the prick of them through his stockings, dozens of tiny needles. The thought of Jenny's going was a dirk right through his heart. It hurt to breathe. He knew she could tell. She didn't look at him, but coiled up the pearl rosary neatly, and, taking his hand, dropped it into his palm.
Keep it for me, she said, matter-of-factly. And if I dinna come back, give it to Mandy when she's old enough.
Jenny, he said softly.
See, when you come to reckon your life, she said briskly, stooping to pick up the goat's rope, you see that it's the bairns are most important. They carry your blood, and they carry whatever else you gave them, on into the time ahead.
Her voice was perfectly steady, but she cleared her throat with a tiny before going on.
Mandy's the farthest out, eh? She said, as far as I can reach. The youngest girl of Mam's blood. Let her take it on, then.
He swallowed hard.
I will, he said,
and closed his hand over the beads, warm from his sister's touch, warm with her prayers.
I swear, sister.
Well, I ken that, Clotilde, she said, smiling up at him. Come and help me catch these goats.
Part 4. A Journey of 1,000 Miles. Chapter 59. Special Requests. Jamie handed Ian a small, heavy purse.
I can manage, Uncle, he said, trying to hand it back. We've horses and I've got enough coin to feed us, I think.
You'd be happy enough to sleep in the woods along the way, and Rachel's young and strong, and doubtless she'd do it for love of you. But if you think you can make your mother travel 700 miles, sleeping by the side of the road, and eating what you can catch along the way, think again, aye?
Mm-hmm.
Ian acknowledged the reason in this, though he weighed the purse reluctantly in the palm of his hand.
Besides, his uncle added, and glanced over his shoulder, there's a fever I'd ask of you.
Of course, Uncle Jimmy.
Auntie Claire was out in the side yard helping with the laundry. He saw his uncle's eye rest on her with a mingled look of affection and wariness that piqued Ian's interest.
What is it?
Rachel says you mean to stop in Philadelphia for a few days on your way, so she can visit some of her Quaker friends and go to a proper meeting.
Aye, so? Well, About 5 miles outside the city, along the main road, there's a small lane. It's called Mulberry. I've drawn you a map, but you can ask your way too. There's a wee falling down sort of a house at the end of the lane that belongs to a woman named Sylvia Hardman.
A woman?
Ian glanced involuntarily at Auntie Clare too. She was laughing at something Jem had once said to her. Her face flushed from the heat of the fire, and her mad hair escaping from the scarf she had bound around her head.
"Aye,"
his uncle said tersely, turning slightly so his back was to the launderers. "A Quaker lady, a widow, with 3 small girls. She did me a great service before Monmouth, and since you'll be passing by, I'd like you to see what her condition is, and no matter what it is, oblige her to take this." He fished in his sporran and came out with another, smaller purse. Ian accepted it without question, putting it away in his own pouch. Uncle Jamie was frowning slightly, hesitant.
"Anything else, Uncle? I dinna ken whether. Whatever it is, a brath or mather, ye ken I'll do it, eh?"
He smiled at Uncle Jamie, who relaxed and smiled back.
"I do, Ian, and I'm grateful. The thing is, friend Sylvia is a virtuous woman, but her husband was killed maybe by the British Army, maybe by Loyalists, maybe by Indians. He left her badly off. She's no kin, and there aren't so many ways for a woman alone to provide for 3 wee girls.
"She's a whore, then?"
Ian had lowered his own voice, keeping an eye on the steam rising from the laundry kettle. Wee Ori Higgins was minding Oggy, and apparently trying to teach him to play patty cake, though the bairn couldn't manage more than waving his chubby arms and crowing.
"No," Uncle Jamie's face darkened. "She sometimes..."
"I understand," Ian said hastily, suddenly wondering at the nature of the service Mrs. Hardman might have rendered his uncle.
"Not me, for God's sake."
"I didn't think it was, Uncle."
"Aye, you did,"
Uncle Jamie said dryly. "But beyond rubbing horseradish liniment into my backside and poulticing my back, the woman never laid a hand on me, nor I on her, all right?" Ian grinned at his uncle and raised both hands, indicating a complete acceptance of this story.
"So, as I said, I want you to see what her condition is. It may be that she's found a man to marry her, and if she has, you be damned careful about giving her the money so he doesn't see. Even if he's a good man, he might assume things that aren't true."
And here he gave Ian a hard look.
"But if she's entertaining men that come to her house, you find that out, and make sure that none of them are threatening her or seem a danger to her or her wee lassies. And if they are, take care of it."
I found Ian in the spring house, sniffing cheeses. "Take that one," I suggested, pointing at a cheesecloth-wrapped shape at the end of the top shelf. "It's at least 6 months old, so it'll be hard enough to travel with. Oh, but you might want some of the softer cheese for Oggy, mightn't you?" There were at least a dozen tin tubs of soft goat's cheese, some flavoured with garlic and chives, one adventurous experiment with minced dried tomatoes that I had severe doubts about, but 4 unflavoured, for use in feeding people with digestive upset and for mixing in medicines that I couldn't get anyone to swallow otherwise.
"Rachel thinks he might be teething," Ian assured me. "By the time we reach New York, he'll be gnawing raw meat off the bone."
I laughed, but felt a sharp pang at the realization that he was right. By the time we saw Oggy again, he would likely be walking, perhaps talking, and fully equipped to eat anything that took his fancy.
"He might even have a proper name by that time," I said,
and Ian smiled, shaking his head.
"You never ken when a person's right name will come, but it always does."
He glanced down to one side by reflex, to where Rollo would have been. "Wolf's brother," I said. That was the name the Mohawk had given him when he became one of them. I was quite aware, and I thought Rachel and Jenny both knew it even better, that he had by no means stopped being a Mohawk,
even though he'd come back to live with us again. He hadn't stopped looking down at his side for Rollo either.
"Aye,"
he said, a little gruffly, but then he gave me a half-smile, and the Scottish lad showed through the tattoos.
"Maybe another wolf will come find me sometime."
"I hope so," I said, meaning it. "Ian, I wanted to ask you a favour." One eyebrow went up.
"Name it, auntie."
"Well, Jamie said that you planned to stop in Philadelphia. I wondered..." I felt myself blushing, much to my annoyance. His other eyebrow rose.
"Whatever it is, auntie, I'll do it,"
he said, one side of his mouth curling. "I promise." "Well, I want you to go to a brothel." The eyebrows came down, and he stared hard at me, obviously thinking he hadn't heard aright. "A brothel," I repeated somewhat louder, "in Elphith's Alley." He stood motionless for a moment, then turned and put the cheese back on the shelf and glanced down at the clear brown water of the creek rushing past our feet.
"This might take a bit of time to explain, eh? Let's go out into the sun."
Chapter 60. Just One Step. September 15th, 1779.
Just one step. That's all it ever took, all it ever takes.
Sometimes you see such a step coming from a long way off. Sometimes you never notice until you look backward. Here it was, right in front of her. The door of her cabin. Hers. Her home. The home of her marriage, of her baby's first months, of her realest life, was open to the morning, and the round gold leaves of the aspens lay flat on the wood of the stoop, gleaming with dew as the dawn came up. One step over the threshold that divided her small rag rug, with its quiet, homely blues and greys, from that pagan abandon of golds and greens and red outside, and her life here was over.
They might come back. Ian had promised that they would,
and she trusted that he'd do whatever he could to make it so. But even if they did, it would be a different life.
Oggy. Perhaps he would be walking, talking, might have a different name by then.
He wouldn't recall this early life, the closeness of waking against her body in bed, turning at once to her breast and yielding up his separate existence so easily. Becoming one with her, as he'd been when she carried him inside, just for those moments while he fed from her again. Somewhere he might be weaned, on the road between now and then. He would be a different person when they came back. So would she. Jenny came up beside her, her face bright and a pack with food and drink, handkerchiefs, clouts, and clean stockings under her arm. She glanced at Rachel's face, then at the inside of the cabin as though making an inventory. There was little enough to take note of. The rug, the bed, and its trundle where Jenny slept. Oggy's cradle. They'd already given everything else away. What they needed would be given back or built again if they returned.
"Well then, laddie," Jenny said to Oggy, "this will be your first journey from home, aye? It's my third. Just pay attention to me. I'll see you right."
Oggy promptly leaned out of Rachel's arms, reaching for his granny, who laughed and took him.
"You're fettled, Monsacht," she said to Rachel. "Is the sense of the meeting clear?"
"Let's be off then, and see what lies ahead."
The first step took them from the cabin to the big house to take their leave. They'd said goodbye to Brianna and Roger and seen them off with their wagon full of children and contraband sauerkraut 3 weeks before, an experience that had made Rachel's heart uneasy. Now she was inexpressibly relieved to see Jamie and hear that he intended to accompany the travellers on the 3-day journey to Salisbury in the Piedmont, where they would find the great wagon road that would take them north.
"I need to meet with a few men there,"
Jamie had said, with a casual reserve that she knew was meant to protect her own feelings. She knew his business was that of war, and he knew how much that troubled her. But she knew how much it troubled him, and would not force him to say things he was thinking, let alone the things he knew. She'd felt moved to speak about it, the war, in general, in meeting. And then she'd talked about her brother Denzel, a friend from birth, as she was, a godly man, but also a doctor and a man of conscience.
Such men aren't always comfortable to live with, she'd said, half apologetically.
But more than one woman had smiled in sympathy, knowing what she meant.
But I wouldn't have him otherwise, thee knows. And he's of the mind that God has called him to the battlefield, not to fight with a musket or sword, but to fight death itself in the name of liberty.
She'd drawn a deep breath then, and added, I have had word that my brother was captured, and is in a British prison. I'd ask thee all, please, to pray for him. They had nodded, solemn, and Jamie Fraser had crossed himself, which moved her. Jamie nearly always came to meeting, but seldom spoke himself. He'd come in quietly and sit on a back bench, head bowed, listening. Listening, as any friend would, to the silence and his inner light. When people felt moved of the spirit to speak, he would listen courteously to them too, but watching the remoteness of his face on these occasions, she thought his mind was still by itself, in quiet, persistent search.
"I dinna suppose young Ian's told you much about Catholics," he'd said to her once, when he'd paused afterward to give her a fleece he'd brought from Salem.
"Only when I ask him," she said with a smile, "and thee knows he's no theologian. Roger Mack knows more, I think, regarding Catholic belief and practice."
"Does he want to tell me something about Catholics? I know thee must feel seriously outnumbered every first day."
He'd smiled at that, and it made her heart glad to see it. He was so often troubled these days, and no wonder.
"Nay, lass, God and I get on well enough by ourselves. It's only that when I come to your meeting, sometimes it reminds me of a thing Catholics do now and then. It's no a formal thing, but a body will go and sit for an hour before the sacrament in church. I do it now and then when I was a young man in Paris. We call it adoration."
"What does thee do during that hour?"
she'd asked, curious. "Nothing in particular. Pray for the most part, say the rosary, or sit in silence. Read, maybe, the Bible or the writings of some saint. I've seen folks sing sometimes. I remember once going into the chapel of St. Joseph in the wee hours of the morning, long before dawn. Almost all the candles were burnt out, and hearing someone playing a guitar, singing, very soft, not playing to be heard, Ken, just singing before God."
Something odd moved in his eyes at the recollection, but then he smiled at her again, a rueful smile.
"I think that may be the last music I remember really hearing."
"What?"
He touched the back of his head briefly.
"I was struck in the head wi' an axe many years gone. I lived, but I never heard music again. The pipes, fiddles, singing. I ken it's music, but to me it's nae more than noise. But that song. I dinna recall the song itself, but I know how I felt when I heard it."
She'd never before seen a look on his face as she did when he called back that song for her. But now, watching his back, straight and square as he rode before them, quite suddenly she felt what he had felt in the depth of